Some kill, they're leaving it very open.
Hello, 90s footy fans. Welcome to episode 64 of the 90s Club Footy Podcast. This week, we chat with longtime AFL assistant coach, Alan McConnell. Alan, who hails from the Western District, played VFL football with Footscray in the 1980s, playing 37 games and kicking 5 goals. He's renowned for his coaching, having coached at Fitzroy, Geelong and the GWS Giants in a career that has spanned almost 30 years. Alan was interim coach of Fitzroy twice, once in 1995 after the departure of Burnley Quinlan, and then again in 1996 for the Lions' final ever 8 games. In this episode, Alan talks about how his coaching journey started, how he made his way to Fitzroy, being interim coach of the Lions twice, the emotions of the club's last ever match, working at Geelong, officially becoming the GWS Giants' first ever employee, and coaching in the AFLW. I hope you enjoy the 64th member of the 90s Club Footy Podcast, Alan McConnell. Alan McConnell, thank you for joining me on the 90s Club Footy Podcast. Really appreciate you taking the time to come on and have a chat and reflect on what was a great era of football.
Pleasure, Trent. Good to be here.
Mate, you've been in the AFL system for a very long time, obviously from Fitzroy and even before that, and I know you've still got some involvement with the GWS Giants. What are you doing with yourself currently? I know you've got a couple of, a bit of a diverse role, still with some football, but some other sports as well.
Yeah, look, I have a bit of a contract to work with their coaches at the Giants, with a particular reference to their academy coaches across southern New South Wales, Canberra and Western Sydney. And then I've also got a role working within the Australian Sports Commission at the AIS, looking after the development of a whole range of Olympic sports coaches who are basically on apprenticeship schemes, if you like, looking to maybe be coaching in Brisbane in 2032. So I've got a stable of about 25 or 30 Olympic sports coaches whose development I look after, ranging from lawn bowls, table tennis, rugby sevens, triathlon, rowing, boxing, you name it. I'm involved in it.
Mate, what a busy role. And I guess, as you said, with the Olympics coming up, it's going to be a pretty important time to get those elements right in readiness for the Brisbane Olympics, which hopefully Australia can do pretty well at.
Yeah, look, Olympic Games is a big deal, particularly for me when I was a young kid. You know, I remember, you know, hanging out every 4 years to sit up in the wee small hours of the night to watch what was going on in those things, and to somehow have a touch point to that now is quite intriguing.
I want to look at your footy journey, and one that's, yeah, you've been around the football caper for a long, long time, Alan, and I'm looking forward to sort of reflecting on your time in the game. Before we look at your coaching journey, which is what I'm sort of got you on the podcast for, because you've been in the coaching fraternity for such a long, long time. Tell us a bit about some of your earliest memories when you were running around with Footscray in the old VFL.
It's a while ago now. hard to remember. I remember we weren't much good. I remember feeling that, you know, it was a struggle for me to sort of survive at that level. I was probably a better coach than I was a player. But I think the struggles I had to be a player and how hard I had to work at it probably made me a better coach, if that's true. Look, great times, and I'm really proud of what I accomplished. But I've spent far more time in the footy as a coach than I was as a player.
How did you get down to Footscray, mate? Obviously, I know you're from the Hampton region around, I think, Newark or around that area. How did you get to Footscray? Because I reckon, was Fitzroy sort of the area where a lot of the players went down at that stage when you went down to Melbourne?
Yeah, that's true. Look, what happened was we're playing for Coolora in the, actually Coolora and then Terang. I had one season at Terang in the Handy League before I moved to Melbourne to study. My brother, who was much bigger and taller than me, and probably met more of a profile of an AFL player, had been invited to go down and play in a practice match for Fitzroy. And I pretty pretentiously took my bag along and asked if I could have a kick. And wouldn't cut it these days. And in fact, I had a go. I had a crack. I got asked back and he didn't. So played under 19s with Fitzroy, won a best and fairest. Got pretty sick with meningitis and glandular fever. And by the time I'd got over that, missed the boat. Went and played Preston in the VFA in those days, as it was. And the under-19s coach from Fitzroy, who'd kept tabs on me, Graham Calverley, had transitioned across to being the under-19s coach at the Doggies. And he was integral in when I got back to full health and getting me over to the Bulldogs.
Now, coaching's been a big part of your life, Al. There's no doubt about that. Where was your first coaching gig within the VFL-AFL system, and how did it transpire?
Okay, so played at Footscray for 3 years, went back to play VFA at Preston, did my knee in a rep game playing for Victoria against, I can't remember who it was now, maybe it was South Australia, or can't remember who we were playing against, and lost my spot in the team. They went on and won a premiership, and I decided, the coach at that time was Ray Shaw. And I felt that Ray could have looked after me better than he did. And so for the first time in my playing career, I'd gone from being a model player, if you like, you know, very compliant, doing all the right things, to probably being hard work, and figured that if I thought I knew better, I'd better have a go at it myself. So I had a mate who was playing at East Burwood, who I'd played with at Fitzroy, and somehow I found myself coaching that team, which is East Burwood in the Eastern District Footy League. And we went on and won a premiership. Went to the Diamond Valley in Melbourne. Got to a grand final, got sacked, which is interesting. And then did some work post that the Doncaster area of Melbourne, which at that stage was Fitzroy's recruiting zone, metropolitan recruiting zone. And that ultimately led them to asking me to be their under-19s coach.
We know you pretty well because you had two stints as caretaker coach of Fitzroy, 1995 after the departure of the great super boot Bernie Quinlan, and then obviously in 1996 replacing Mick Noonan, I think it was halfway through the year or towards the back end of the year. Did you enjoy stepping up on both occasions, mate? I know that role of assistant, but then to stepping up and being that main man for those games that you needed to, how did you enjoy the chance?
First of all, Fitzroy was fabulous to me. I learned an awful lot of life lessons and football lessons as a result of the experiences that I had at Fitzroy. And I'll always be grateful for the part that that club played in my development as a person, as a coach. I enjoyed it. I was probably petrified in lots of ways, particularly the media and how that would all play out, because Bernie was, you know, obviously, you know, a very respected player, and replacing somebody of that standing, it wasn't easy. So I was probably fairly guarded in a lot of ways. I actually did apply for the job, the full-time job for 96, and they appointed Mick Noonan, and I stayed on as his assistant. And then when they announced the merger, he jumped ship. And to be honest, I actually didn't really want to take over the second time, because I'm of the opinion that if you stand in front of a group of players, you need to be able to, you need to believe you can make a difference. And I couldn't see for the life of me how, as their coach, I was going to make a difference. And anyway, there was a group of the senior players, including the captain, who insisted that I be their coach for that remaining eight games. And after a bit of argy-bargy and negotiation, that's what happened.
After 1995, and you said you put in to take the role on full-time, and obviously Mick Noonan got it. Did you get much feedback? Were you far away from getting it, you know, getting that opportunity, obviously, from what you'd done in 1995?
Well, they indicated I wasn't far away, but in this gig, second's a long way off first, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
There's no second prizes, so, you know, like, you move on. I actually had a bit of a chat with Carlton at the same time from memory, and that didn't materialise in anything. So, I was happy to stay at Fitzroy. Little did we know that the slippery slope that we were going to be a part of in the following 12 months.
Was there any sort of talk about 96 was going to be the last year for the Lions? Like from that pre-season, did you have much of an inkling that it was going to happen, or was it sort of just rumour and a bit of talk, you know, outside?
Well, history says that the negotiations were going on in about November of that year between the board, as I understand it, and North Melbourne, which obviously didn't materialise. But we weren't party to any of that. In fact, really at no stage, even right up until the day that the receivership was announced, we really weren't briefed by the board at all as to what was happening. The information we got was basically what everybody else was reading in the paper and or rumour and innuendo or, you know, various connections we might have had through the industry. So it was a pretty tough time in that regard, and probably more difficult on the family because, they were often finding out things at the same time as I did because they were in the paper or on the radio. And,
yeah.
And so, therefore, the ability to manage that effectively was pretty tough on the family.
So you spoke about Mick after coach 14 games, and I think obviously once it was sort of known that things were going to occur, you got the last 8 weeks, and it was interesting just to listen to what you said before. So how did you make the mindset positive going into that last 8 weeks with all the emotion that was occurring, no doubt with on-field and off-field, and I guess, you know, where positions were going to lie for players in 1997 and the like? What was the sort of the thing that you tried to achieve more than anything to keep a positive environment?
Well, the first thing was that because the players had sort of driven the agenda about me being their coach, because the AFL had gone to Curly Austin and asked him to do it, and he knocked them back. And the players told me that they didn't want him anyway. But I sort of wanted to make clear to the, I had to make clear to the players from the outset that that didn't make me them my master, if you like, so that, you know, I was the boss and that I was going to do it my way. And I had a few different ideas to, you know, what Mick had, both in terms of the way we're training and how we wanted to play. So that that probably helped me for a few weeks because, you know, when things are, you know, we'd get one game and, you know, the environment was pretty dour, there was a bit of a honeymoon period in terms of the way we played over the next couple of weeks. But the longer it went on, the perception externally was that because we were under siege and players were going everywhere, that it would galvanise and connect the playing group. And, in fact, the exact opposite was the case. So what happened is pretty quickly Brisbane privately and then publicly committed to 7 or 8 players going up there as part of the merger. There was another group of probably 8 or 10 players who were probably pretty confident that they were going to get a go somewhere else. We had a group of older blokes who were pretty clear it was probably going to be the end. And then we had another group that basically, you know, had no sense of what was going on. Like the guys were playing in the twos, you know, like, where am I going to go? So, in fact, because the playing list all had different experiences and were at different stages of evolution in terms of new contracts and how they were going to get to new clubs or not, actually fractured the group rather than united it. And so the longer it went, the more difficult it became to manage, if you like. And certainly that's how if you look at the chronologically, the results over that last 7 or 8 weeks, we had some pretty good contests early. We performed pretty well against West Coast in West Coast. We pushed Collingwood at Victoria Park. But the closer we got to the end, the more difficult it was to manage and find reasons to unite and unite the group, because in the end, you know, like, there was plenty of talent on the AFL on the Fitzroy list, albeit that a lot of the really experienced talent had left. The number of players that got opportunities elsewhere would indicate that everybody else thought there was a lot of talent there too. But with no experience in that, managing something that nobody else had ever had to put up with became pretty goddamn hard work.
Those last two games, you know, the game against Richmond, the last one in Melbourne, which was disappointing that it wasn't the very last round of the season rather than the second last. But, you know, the performance, it was a big loss to the Tigers, and obviously that last game against Frio. And for you, that would have been pretty draining. I would have thought those last 2 weeks, just with the emotion riding and, I guess, you know, even furthering the uncertainty of where the players are going to be, you know, in 1997 and the like, those 2 weeks would have been pretty draining, I would have thought.
Yeah, I'd come back another week. I think we played Brisbane the third last game of the season. And everybody was saying, oh, you know, it's a dress rehearsal for the guys to, you know, get a gig with their new club. But in fact, at that stage, whilst it wasn't public knowledge, Brisbane had already pretty much committed to who they were going to take. So those blokes, in some regards, didn't want to get injured. They had their cues in the rack. You know, like they, so it was, we got a big belting by them. And then we get to, you know, what was many people sort of saw as the last game, which was not the last game really, but the second last one, but because of the MCG in Melbourne, was perceived as the last hurrah. And it was 183 points or something we got belted by. And if that wasn't bad enough, then they made us do a lap of honour after the game. And so the jumpers needed to go around the boundary, but unfortunately they needed people inside them. And that was almost cruel, to be honest, because I understand the respect that needed to be shown to the members and supporters and the football public, you know, in terms of honouring the history of a great club. But for the people in those jumpers, it was pretty a pretty challenging experience. And in fact, in the, if you have a look at the annual general report for the AFL from that year, there's a photo of myself and Brad Boyd, the captain, standing in the centre circle in the middle of the MCG post that game, and I've got my arm around him, whispering in his ear, and the caption in the photograph says something to the effect that refers to the special relationship that exists between the captain and his coach. And in fact, what was really going on is he was telling me to get stuffed. There was no chance we were going to go. They were going to go around the boundary, and that, you know, the lap of honour was off. And I'm saying, mate, they'll lynch us if we don't. So we're actually having this massive blue, but because I knew people would be watching, it was made to look like something completely different to the conversation we were having.
Geez, that would have been a hard thing to do, to make the guys go around the oval, as you said. Like, yeah, the jumper had to go around, but, you know, for people to feel it and so forth after, you know, getting belted by nearly 30 goals, geez, that would have been hard to even entice the boys to go around one last time.
And the worst part was, because of the circumstances, in any other circumstances, the crowd would have all left, but they all stayed.
You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, Al.
Look, in hindsight, amazing experience, but was it good at the time? No chance.
Hey, I want to ask you, after your time at Fitzroy, did you have many clubs seek out your services to join their coaching staff? Obviously, I know you went to the Cats in 97 and were there for quite a few years, but you have many other clubs sort of make a phone call and touch base with you?
Yeah, I spent a bit of time talking with both Melbourne and the Cats, and decided ultimately to go to the Cats.
Tell me a bit about your time at the Cats. Obviously, a really proud club. You had a lot of stars still floating around at that stage at Geelong. Different environment to Fitzroy, I guess. How did you enjoy your time at the Cats?
Yeah, it was a good time. We had a fabulous first season in 97. I think we finished top or second top, and then got absolutely crucified. We played our first final against North Melbourne on a Sunday night at the MCG. Yep. And lost. And of course, in those days, the Geelong faithful didn't come up the highway. So, you know, it was a pretty, you know, North Melbourne were in those days also the, you know, the nighttime specialist, if you like. They'd spent a lot of time doing that. And then the following week, we were the highest qualifying loser, but got sent to Adelaide, who got us there. So we went out in straight sets, which was pretty disappointing. You know, would have been nice to have gone from the bottom of the ladder to a premiership, but it didn't happen.
Mate, I'm a Cats fan, and I still have memories of that day. Colbert taking the mark and Buddha Hocking touching the footy on the line. What were you guys thinking in the commentary? In the coach's box when Colby's taken that absolute hanger and was in range for a goal?
Well, new corner to hanger. Unfortunately, the umpire said it was. So it was pretty courageous. Went back with a fly to the ball. The game's about moments, isn't it?
Yeah.
And yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't our moment.
And you were there for a couple of seasons, mate, and I guess it was an interesting time too, as you said, because I guess, you know, Hinkley, Ablett, Couch, Brownless, they were making their way out, and it was a transition time for the Cats to some degree.
Yeah, it was. Very much so. So the end of the very end of an era, you know, as you said, some superstars of the game who'd played in all those losing grand finals. And then the evolution of the new Geelong, or the beginnings of the evolution of the new Geelong. So I was privileged enough to both coach Gary Ablett and his son. In fact, I taught his son to drive. He used to drive to Torquay and pick him up, and he'd drive me to training with the L plates on.
Geez, there wouldn't be many people have boasted that record, mate, playing, coaching an absolute star and their son that's come through the ranks as well. You'd be one of very few, I would have thought.
I've coached a lot of people, mate. Been around a long time. So, yeah.
Hey, and then obviously the next part of your journey was GWS, Alan. Obviously, you'd been there since 2009. You were one of the first employees, I reckon, of the footy club from a coaching point of view. Must have been a great experience to start up with a new club that's fresh into the game and, I guess, have a bit of ownership sort the direction that you wanted to take the club into from a coaching perspective.
Yeah, well, in fact, I was the first employee of the club. So there was a period of about 3 months where I entered the room, the entire club had arrived. So no direct bosses that I answered to on a daily basis. So that was pretty cool for a short period of time. But I fairly quickly amassed a whole range of bosses in a whole range of areas, including Sheets and Gubby Allen and Dale Holmes, and then eventually Dave Matthews. An amazing experience. And I said earlier, you know, how good Fitzroy had been to me. You know, like, I think what my experiences at Fitzroy in many ways prepared me as much or anything for what was to come at the Giants, simply because it's a bit like when you're at a club that goes into demise, it's sort of a bit like driving down a highway into the sunset. And in fact, when you're at a new club, at a startup club, it's the opposite. You're on the same highway, but you go in the opposite direction. So you're starting with absolutely nothing. like you are when you finish at a club, you know, when there's no resources. So you're starting with no resources, but in fact, you're amassing them as opposed to losing them. So I always sort of see it as being a bit, you know, like going on the same highway, but different directions. And, so amazing experience, you know, for the first 5 years, you're probably doing something new or different for the first time every week. And to the club's great credit, growth and change is usually not linear. It's, you know, usually up and down and twists and turns. And to be honest, on nearly every parameter for that first 10 years, we had growth. And, I'm talking membership, I'm talking performance, I'm talking just about any parameter you want to measure by, you know, sponsors, all those sort of things. We had growth year on year, that was an amazing thing to be a part of. And unfortunately, we buggered it up on grand final day in 19.
You've been an assistant coach in the modern day and in both the 90s, and I guess, you know, head coach as well with Fitzroy. How has the role changed? And I guess, how is it sort of still the same? So what are some of the similarities that still come with the job? But how much has the role changed overall from the role of assistant coach from when you first started to now?
Well, I think one of the advantages I have in my role now, you know, well, first of all, as the director of coaching of the Giants, and more particularly recently head coach of the women, and more particularly as the, you know, in the coach development space right now, is you actually have to be, in those early days, you have to be a jack of all trades. It's a bit like being the head coach of the local footy club. You've actually got to be able to be pretty good at just about everything and have a couple of things that you're really good at. Whereas today, you have an area of expertise and you need to stick in your lane, because with 30-odd staff members in the footy department plus, you can easily tread on other people's toes and be, not adding to the flow of the joint but compromising it. So that would be the first thing, is that, you know, that ability to be, to develop a diverse skill set, which I think has been great for my career, is a big difference. I think the technology's changed things a lot. You know, when I first started running a team meeting, was copying from the game tape, which is a videotape, onto a second tape, three or four edit. And when you watch through the tape the first time, you write down, you know, the time on the counter on the video machine where the edit was. And by the time you'd shuttled backwards and forwards on the tape two or three times to put the new bit of footage into the right order, the tape would have stretched and you couldn't find the bloody edit anymore. So now you just press a button and it spits out any number of statistical pieces of information that are reinforced by the bit of video footage that it applies to. So, you know, the watching footage from behind the goals, which means you can coach decision-making off the ball, in many ways it's actually easier to do all that than it used to be. It's more but the cost of that is that the game on some levels has become more complex and, some would argue better for it, and others would argue maybe the opposite to that. So, they're some of the things that I think have changed.
Hey, mate, at the end of my podcast, I always ask my guests a couple of quick questions. So a quick handball question. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to give you four names of people involved in your time coaching and so forth back in the 90s. And I just want you to give me one word to share your experience with them, or one word to describe, you know, the relationship and so forth. So the first one I'm going to ask you, Kevin Sheedy, one word to describe Sheeds.
Interesting.
We could do a whole podcast on Sheeds, I reckon. No,
yeah. How long have you got? That interesting doesn't do it justice. He's an icon of the game, an interesting cat, different, unique, less field, has a really good heart, you know. So, but you'd want to be on his camp, you wouldn't want to be on the other team.
What about Gary Ayres? Obviously a very passionate coach, played the game tough. What about Ayrsy?
Passionate, driven, focused. He had the best stare. Without trying, he could intimidate people just because of the way he looked at you. So, yeah, and probably that didn't do him justice at times, you know, but, he had a good career. He had a great career as a coach.
I want to go two Fitzroy players, mate. Matty Primus, we only probably saw him for a season or two whilst you're at the Lions, but terrific player in the end. A comment about Matty Primus?
Very, very good player and a great leader, you know. Like, unfortunate because of injury that he didn't become a premiership captain, not just a captain of an AFL club, and, you know, had a great career. And it's fabulous that, you know, he was able to, continue the legacy of his grandparents, who had a huge impact on footy at the Geelong Footy Club.
And the last one I want to ask you about is Chris Johnson. What a great player he was, both at Fitzroy but also too at the Brisbane Lions.
Yeah. It's interesting, my experience with Chris, he was a baby, you know, like very, very young, limited life experience. I remember him crying on the track, might have been the Thursday night, the week that the merger was announced, you know, worrying about who was going to look after him and what this all meant, and thinking that, you know, maybe his career was all over. And what a superstar he turned into, eh?
Absolutely, an absolute star, that's for sure. Mate, who's the one player that stands out to you that you look back on now and think, yeah, I feel pretty privileged I had a role in their career?
Your listeners probably won't know who this is, but I would say Cora Staunton.
Right. So one of the early girls from the Giants, am I guessing, or?
Yeah, Cora is the first international to come and play AFLW, Irish woman, yep. Superstar of the Gaelic game, one of the greatest players in the last, one of the, she's named in the 100 greatest athletes in Irish history in the last 100 years.
Right.
And driven, focused, courageous, probably the most driven athlete I've ever coached, bar none. And if you look up her history, an absolute privilege to have coached her, and she's a trailblazer. I think there's now something like 35 Irish women or thereabouts going to play AFLW next year. She was the first. She set the pattern. She's now the godmother of them all, and without exception, they all ring her to get advice on whether it's a good idea and how it's all going to work. So really proud of her.
Mate, can you remember the biggest spray, and maybe if there was a player that might have copped an Alan McConnell spray on one occasion back in the 90s? There's probably a couple.
No, I remember losing my, losing the plot one day in the coach's box at Western Oval. I think I was coaching Fitzroy's reserves, and we'd had a good year the year before, and we weren't going so well. And I was frustrated. And I remember I think I might have lit up the dashboard on the ABC because I think my colourful language might have been filtering through the paper thin walls onto their radio broadcast. So that was probably not my finest hour.
And, mate, the last question I want to ask you, and I've really appreciated your time, is what's your best football achievement? What's the thing that stands out most in your coaching in your coaching career?
Can I give you three?
Yeah, absolutely.
The people I've coached and the privilege it is to have been a part of their lives and their careers. That's number one by the length of the straight. Number two, being awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by the AFL Coaches Association, the Neil Danaher Lifetime Achievement Award. I think all of your listeners would understand the standing that Neil Danaher has in the community, not just the football community in Victoria mm-hmm. and around the country. And to be bestowed an award named in his honour is like, it seems like my feeling is like, is that me? Like, did I really do that? You know, am I worthy of that honour? And I think, sadly, won a premiership at East Burwood as a coach, which I'm particularly proud of, but never won a premiership at the AFL level after 30 years of chasing the dream, which annoys me greatly, but being a life member of the Giants probably comes second best because it means that you belong there forever.
Alan McConnell, thank you so much for reflecting on your footy journey. It's been a great one and still many more great seasons to go in the coaching capacity. Thanks for jumping on the podcast.
Cheers, mate.
That's the end of episode number 64. If you've missed any previous episodes, you can catch them all on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Amazon Music. We're on all the social media platforms, so drop us a line on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter on any particular episode you've enjoyed or a guest you'd love to hear. Next week, our guest is former Melbourne and Sydney midfielder, Kevin Dyson.
It's tough, it's rugged, it's good, solid AFL football.